Hello there, and welcome to tonight's episode of Down to Sleep, the podcast of softly spoken stories to help you get a good night's rest. Tonight, a reading of The Secret Garden by Frances Hodgson Burnett. Thank you for joining me. If you'd like to get even more readings, be able to give your opinion on the podcast, get in touch with me and more, join me on Patreon at patreon.com/downtosleep. There is also a YouTube channel if you'd like to get more readings for free. On there, I do a lot of the versions that have the rain sounds in the background. You can find all of the links that you need in the info for this episode, or just go to downtosleeppodcast.com. But wherever you are in the world, let's tuck you in. Take a nice deep breath for me. And let's get down to sleep. The Secret Garden by Frances Hodgson Burnett. The Secret Garden was not the only one that Dickon worked in. Round the cottage on the moor, there was a piece of ground enclosed by a low wall of rough stones. Early in the morning, and late in the fading twilight, and on all the days Colin and Mary did not see him, Dickon worked there, planting or tending potatoes and cabbages, turnips and carrots and herbs for his mother. In the company of his creatures, he did wonders there, and was never tired of doing them, it seemed. While he dug or weeded, he whistled or sang bits of Yorkshire moor songs, or talked to Soot or Captain, or the brothers and sisters he had taught to help him. "We'd never get on as comfortable as we do," Mrs. Sowerby said, "if it wasn't for Dickon's garden. Anything'll grow for him. His taters and cabbages is twice the size of anyone else's, and they've got flavour with them as nobody's has." When she found a moment to spare, she liked to go out and talk to him. After supper, there was still a long, clear twilight to work in, and that was her quiet time. She could sit upon the low, rough wall and look on and hear stories of the day. She loved this time. There were not only vegetables in this garden. Dickon had bought penny packages of flower seeds now and then, and sown bright, sweet-scented things among gooseberry bushes and even cabbages, and he grew borders of mignonette and pinks and pansies and things whose seeds he could save year after year, or whose roots would bloom each spring, and spread in time into fine clumps. The low wall was one of the prettiest things in Yorkshire, because he had tucked moorland foxglove and ferns and rock cress and hedgerow flowers into every crevice, until only here and there glimpses of the stones were to be seen. "All a chap's got to do to make 'em thrive, mother," he would say, "is to be friends with them, for sure. They're just like the creatures. If they're thirsty, give them drink. And if they're hungry, give them a bit of food. They want to live, same as we do. If they died, I should feel as if I'd been a bad lad and somehow treated them heartless." It was in these twilight hours that Mrs. Sowerby heard of all that happened at Misselthwaite Manor. At first, she was only told that Mester Colin had taken a fancy to going out into the grounds with Miss Mary, and that it was doing him good. But it was not long before it was agreed between the two children that Dickon's mother might come into the secret. Somehow, it was not doubted that she was safe for sure. So one beautiful still evening, Dickon told the whole story, with all the thrilling details of the buried key, and the robin, and the grey haze which seemed like deadness, the secret Mistress Mary had planned never to reveal. The coming of Dickon, how it had been told to him, the doubt of Mester Colin, and the final drama of his introduction to the hidden domain, combined with the incident of Ben Weatherstaff's angry face peering over the wall, and Mester Colin's sudden indignant strength. Mrs. Sowerby's nice-looking face quite changed colour several times. "My word," she said, "it was a good thing that little lass came to the manor. It's been the making of her, and the saving of him, standing on his feet, and us all thinking he was a poor half-witted lad with not a straight bone in him." She asked a great many questions, and her blue eyes were full of deep thinking. What do they make of it at Manor, him being so well and cheerful and never complaining? They don't know what to make of it, answered Dickon. Every day as comes round his face looks different. It's filling out and doesn't look so sharp and the waxy colour's going. But he has to do a bit of complaining, with a highly entertained grin. What for, our mercy's name? Asked Mrs. Sowerby. Dickon chuckled. He does it to keep them guessing. If the doctor knew he'd found out he could stand on his feet, he'd likely write and tell Mr. Craven. Mr. Collins saving the secret to tell himself. He's going to practice his magic on his legs every day till his father comes back. Then he's going to march into his room and show him he's as straight as other lads. But him and Miss Mary think it's best plan to do a bit of groaning and fretting now and then to throw folk off the scent. Mrs. Sowerby was laughing, a low, comfortable laugh, long before he had finished his last sentence. "Eh," she said, "that pair's enjoying theirselves, I'll warrant. They'll get a good bit of acting out of it, and there's nothing children like as much as play-acting. Let's hear what they do, Dickon, lad." Dickon stopped weeding and sat up on his heels to tell her. His eyes were twinkling with fun. Mr. Collins carried down to his chair every time he goes out, and he flies out at John the footman for not carrying him careful enough. He makes himself as helpless looking as he can, and he never lifts his head until we're out of sight of house. And he grunts and frets a good bit when he's being settled into his chair. Him and Miss Mary both got to enjoying it, and when he groans and complains, she'll say, "Poor Colin, does it hurt you so much? Are you so weak as that, poor Colin?" But the trouble is that sometimes they can scarce keep from bursting out laughing. When we get safe into the garden, they laugh till they've got no breath left to laugh with, and they have to stuff their faces into Mr. Collins' cushions to keep the gardeners from hearing. "The more they laugh, the better for 'em," said Mrs. Sowerby, still laughing herself. "Good healthy child laughing's better than pills any day of year. That pair'll plump up for sure." "They are plumping up," said Dickon. "They're that hungry they don't know how to get enough to eat without making talk. Mr. Collins says if he keeps sending for more food, they won't believe he's an invalid at all. Miss Mary says she'll let him eat her share, but he says that if she goes hungry, she'll get thin, and their mun both get fat at once." Mrs. Sowerby laughed so heartily at the revelation of this difficulty that she quite rocked backward and forward in her blue cloak, and Dickon laughed with her. "I'll tell thee what, lad," Mrs. Sowerby said when she could speak. "I've thought of a way to help him. When thou goes to him in the morning, thou shalt take a pail of good new milk, and I'll bake him a crusty cottage loaf, or some buns with currants in them, same as you children like. Nothing's so good as fresh milk and bread. Then they could take off the edge of their hunger while they were in the garden, and the fine food they get indoors would polish off the corners." "Hey, mother," said Dickon admiringly, "what a wonder thou art. Thou always sees a way out of things. They was quite in a pother yesterday. They didn't see how they was to manage without ordering up more food. They felt that empty inside. They're two young'uns growing fast, and health's coming back to 'em. Children like that feel like young wolves and food's flesh and blood to 'em," said Mrs. Sowerby. Then she smiled, Dickon's own curving smile. "Hey, but they're enjoying themselves for sure," she said. She was quite right. The comfortable, wonderful mother creature. And she had never been more so than when she said their play-acting would be their joy. Colin and Mary found it one of their most thrilling sources of entertainment. The idea of protecting themselves from suspicion had been unconsciously suggested to them first by the puzzled nurse, and then by Dr. Craven himself. "Your appetite's improving very much, Master Colin," the nurse had said one day. "You used to eat nothing, and so many things disagreed with you. Nothing disagrees with me now, replied Colin. And then seeing the nurse looking at him curiously, he suddenly remembered that perhaps he ought not to appear too well just yet. At least, things don't so often disagree with me. It's the fresh air. Perhaps it is, said the nurse, still looking at him with a mystified expression. But I must talk to Dr. Craven about it. How she stared at you, said Mary when she went away, as if she thought there must be something to find out. I won't have her finding out things, said Colin. No one must begin to find out yet. When Dr. Craven came that morning, he seemed puzzled also. He asked a number of questions to Colin's great annoyance. You stay out in the garden a great deal, he suggested. Where do you go? Colin put on his favourite air of dignified indifference to opinion. I will not let anyone know where I go, he answered. I go to a place I like. Everyone has orders to keep out of the way. I won't be watched and stared at. You know that. You seem to be out all day, but I do not think it's done you harm. Do not think so. The nurse says you eat much more than you have ever done before. Perhaps, said Colin, prompted by a sudden inspiration, perhaps it is an unnatural appetite. I do not think so, as your food seems to agree with you, said Dr. Craven. You're gaining flesh rapidly, and your colour is better. Perhaps I'm bloated and feverish, said Colin, assuming a discouraging air of gloom. People who are not going to live are often different. Dr. Craven shook his head. He was holding Colin's wrist, and he pushed up his sleeve and felt his arm. You're not feverish, he said thoughtfully. And such flesh as you have gained is healthy. If you can keep this up, my boy, we need not talk of dying. Your father will be happy to hear of this remarkable improvement. I won't have him told, Colin broke forth fiercely. It will only disappoint him if I get worse again. And I may get worse this very night. I might have a raging fever. I feel as if I might be beginning to have one now. I won't have letters written to my father. I won't. I won't. You're making me angry, and you know that's bad for me. I feel hot already. I hate being written about and being talked over as much as I hate being stared at. Hush, my boy, Dr. Craven soothed him. Nothing shall be written without your permission. You are too sensitive about things. You must not undo the good which has been done. He said no more about writing to Mr. Craven, and when he saw the nurse, he privately warned her that such a possibility must not be mentioned to the patient. The boy is extraordinarily better, he said. His advance seems almost abnormal. But of course he's doing now of his own free will what we could not make him do before. Still, he excites himself very easily, and nothing must be said to irritate him. Mary and Colin were much alarmed, and talked together anxiously. From this time dated their plan of play-actin. I may be obliged to have a tantrum, said Colin regretfully. I don't want to have one. I'm not miserable enough now to work myself into a big one. Perhaps I couldn't have one at all. That lump doesn't come in my throat now, and I keep thinking of nice things instead of horrible ones. But if they talk about writing to my father, I shall have to do something. He made up his mind to eat less, but unfortunately it was not possible to carry out this brilliant idea when he wakened each morning with an amazing appetite, and the table near his sofa was set with a breakfast of homemade bread and fresh butter, snow-white eggs, raspberry jam and clotted cream. Mary always breakfasted with him, and when they found themselves at the table, particularly if there were delicate slices of sizzling ham, sending forth tempting odours from under a hot silver cover, They would look into each other's eyes in desperation. "I think we shall have to eat it all this morning, Mary," Colin always ended by saying. "We can send away some of the lunch and a great deal of the dinner." But they never found they could send away anything, and the highly polished condition of the empty plates returned to the pantry awakened much comment. "I do wish," Colin would say, "I do wish the slices of ham were thicker. And one muffin each is not enough for anyone." "It's enough for a person who's going to die," answered Mary when she first heard this. "But it's not enough for a person who's going to live. I sometimes feel as if I could eat three when those nice fresh heather and gorse smells from the moor come pouring in at the open window." The morning that Dickon, after they had been enjoying themselves in the garden for about 2 hours, went behind a big rose bush and brought forth 2 tin pails, and revealed that one was full of rich new milk with cream on top of it, and that the other held cottage-made currant buns folded in a clean blue and white napkin, buns so carefully tucked in that they were still hot. There was a riot of surprised joyfulness. What a wonderful thing for Mrs. Sowerby to think of. What a kind, clever woman she must be. How good the buns were. And what delicious, fresh milk. "Magic is in her just as it is in Dickon," said Colin. "It makes her think of ways to do things, nice things. She is a magic person. Tell her we're grateful, Dickon, extremely grateful." He was given to using rather grown-up phrases at times. He enjoyed them. He liked this so much he improved upon it. "Tell her she has been most bounteous and our gratitude is extreme." And then, forgetting his grandeur, he fell to and stuffed himself with buns and drank milk out of the pail in copious draughts, in the manner of any hungry little boy who had been taking unusual exercise and breathing in moorland air, and whose breakfast was more than 2 hours behind him. This was the beginning of many agreeable incidents of the same kind. They actually awoke to the fact that as Mrs. Sowerby had 14 people to provide food for, she might not have enough to satisfy 2 extra appetites every day. So they asked her to let them send some of their shillings to buy things. Dickon made the stimulating discovery that in the wood, in the park outside the garden, where Mary had first found him piping to the wild creatures, there was a deep little hollow where you could build a sort of tiny oven with stones and roast potatoes and eggs in it. Roasted eggs were a previously unknown luxury, and very hot potatoes with salt and fresh butter in them were fit for a woodland king, besides being deliciously satisfying. You could buy both potatoes and eggs and eat as many as you liked without feeling as if you were taking food out of the mouths of 14 people. Every beautiful morning, the magic was worked by the mystic circle under the plum tree, which provided a canopy of thickening green leaves. After the ceremony, Colin always took his walking exercise, and throughout the day he exercised his newly found power at intervals. Each day he grew stronger, and could walk more steadily, and cover more ground. And each day his belief in the magic grew stronger, as well it might. He tried one experiment after another, as he felt himself gaining strength, and it was Dickon who showed him the best things of all. "Yesterday," he said one morning after an absence, "I went to Thwaite for mother, and near the Blue Cow Inn I seed Bob Airworth. He's the strongest chap on moor. He's champion wrestler, and he can jump higher than any other chap and throw a hammer further. He's gone all the way to Scotland for sport some years. He's knowed me ever since I was a little un, and he's a friendly sort. And I asked him some questions. The gentry calls him athlete, and I thought of thee, Mester Colin, and I says, 'How did thou make the muscles stick out that way, Bob? did thou do anything extra to make the cells so strong? And he says, well, yes, lad, I did. A strong man in a show came to Thwaite once, showed me how to exercise me arms and legs and every muscle in my body. And I says, could a delicate chap make himself stronger with them, Bob? And he laughed and says, art thou the delicate chap? And I says, no, but I knows a young gentleman that's getting well of a long illness, and I wish I knowed some of them tricks to tell him about. I didn't say no names, and he didn't ask none. He's friendly, same as I said, and stood up and showed me good-natured like, and I imitated what he did, till I knowed it by heart. Colin had been listening excitedly. Can you show me? He cried. Will you? Aye, to be sure, Dickon answered, getting up. But he says thou mun do em gentle at first, and be careful not to tire thyself. Rest in between times, and take deep breaths, and don't overdo. I'll be careful, said Colin. Show me, Dickon. You are the most magic boy in the world. Dickon stood up on the grass, and slowly went through a carefully practical but simple series of muscle exercises. Colin watched them with widening eyes. He could do a few while he was sitting down. Presently he did a few gentle while he stood upon his already steadied feet. Mary began to do them also. Soot, who was watching the performance, became much disturbed and left his branch. He hopped about restlessly because he could not do them too. From that time, the exercises were part of the day's duties as much as the magic was. It became possible for both Colin and Mary to do more of them each time they tried, and such appetites were the results that, but for the basket Dickon put down behind the bush each morning, would have been lost. But the little oven in the hollow and Mrs. Sowerby's bounties were so satisfying that Mrs. Medlock and the nurse and Dr. Craven became mystified again. You can trifle with your breakfast and seem to disdain your dinner if you are full to the brim with roasted eggs and potatoes and richly frothed new milk and oat cakes and buns and heather honey and clotted cream. They're eating next to nothing, said the nurse. They'll die of starvation if they can't be persuaded to take some nourishment. And yet see how they look. Look, exclaimed Mrs. Medlock indignantly. Eh, I'm moithered to death with them. They're a pair of young Satans, bursting their jackets one day and next turning up their noses at best meals cook can tempt them with. Not a mouthful of that lovely young fowl and bread sauce did they set fork into yesterday. And the poor woman fair invented a pudding for them, and back it sent. She almost cried. She's afraid she'll be blamed if they starve themselves into graves. Dr. Craven came and looked at Colin long and carefully. He wore an extremely worried expression when the nurse talked with him and showed him the almost untouched tray of breakfast she had saved for him to look at. But it was even more worried when he sat down by Colin's sofa and examined him. He had been called to London on business and had not seen the boy for nearly 2 weeks. When young things begin to gain health, they gain it rapidly. The waxen tinge had left. Colin's skin had a warm rose showed through it. His beautiful eyes were clear, and the hollows under them and in his cheeks and temples had filled out. His once dark, heavy locks had begun to look as if they sprang healthily from his forehead and were soft and warm with life. His lips were fuller and of a normal colour. In fact, as an imitation of a boy who was a confirmed invalid, he was a disgraceful sight. Dr. Craven held his chin in his hands and thought him over. I am sorry to hear that you do not eat anything, he said. That will not do. You will lose all you've gained, and you've gained amazingly. You ate so well a short time ago. I told you it was an unnatural appetite, answered Colin. Mary was sitting on her stool nearby, and she suddenly made a very queer sound, which she tried so violently to repress that she ended up almost choking. "What's the matter?" said Dr. Craven, turning to look at her. Mary became quite severe in her manner. "It was something between a sneeze and a cough," she replied with reproachful dignity. "And it got in my throat." "But," afterwards she said to Colin, "I couldn't stop myself. It just burst out because all at once I couldn't help remembering that last big potato you ate. The way your mouth stretched when you bit through that thick, lovely crust with jam and clotted cream on it." "Is there any way in which those children can get food secretly?" Dr. Craven inquired of Mrs. Medlock. "There's no way unless they dig it out of the earth or pick it off the trees," Mrs. Medlock answered. "They stay out in the grounds all day and see no one but each other. And if they want anything different to eat from what's sent up to them, they need only ask for it." "Well," said Dr. Craven, "so long as going without food agrees with them, we need not disturb ourselves. The boy is a new creature." "So is the girl," said Mrs. Medlock. "She's begun to be downright pretty since she filled out and lost her ugly little sour look. Her hair's grown thick and healthy looking, and she's got a bright colour. The glummest, ill-natured little thing she used to be, and now her and Master Colin laugh together like a pair of crazy young ones. Perhaps they're growing fat on that." "Perhaps they are," said Dr. Craven. "Let them laugh." And the secret garden bloomed and bloomed, and every morning revealed new miracles. In the robin's nest, there were eggs, and the robin's mate sat upon them, keeping them warm with her feathery little breast and careful wings. At first, she was very nervous, and the robin himself was indignantly watchful. Even Dickon did not go near the close-grown corner in those days, but waited until by the quiet working of some mysterious spell, he seemed to have conveyed to the soul of the little pair that in the garden there was nothing which was not quite like themselves. Nothing which did not understand the wonderfulness of what was happening to them. The immense, tender, terrible, heartbreaking beauty and solemnity of eggs. If there had been one person in that garden who had not known through all his or her innermost being that if an egg were taken away or hurt, the whole world would whirl round and crash through space and come to an end. If there had been even one who did not feel it and act accordingly, there could have been no happiness, even in that golden springtime air. But they all know it and felt it. And the robin and his mate knew they knew it. At first, the robin watched Mary and Colin with sharp anxiety. For some mysterious reason, he knew he need not watch Dickon. The first moment he set his dew-bright black eye on Dickon, he knew he was not a stranger, but a sort of robin without beak or feathers. He could speak robin, which is quite a distinct language, not to be mistaken for any other. To speak robin to a robin is like speaking French to a Frenchman. Dickon always spoke it to the robin himself, so the queer gibberish that he spoke to humans did not matter in the least. The robin thought he spoke this gibberish to them because they were not intelligent enough to understand feathered speech. His movements also were robin. They never startled one by being sudden enough to seem dangerous or threatening. Any robin could understand Dickon, so his presence was not even disturbing. But at the outset, it seemed necessary to be on guard against the other two. In the first place, the boy creature did not come into the garden on his legs. He was pushed in on a thing with wheels, and the skins of wild animals were thrown over him. That in itself was doubtful. Then, when he began to stand up and move about, he did it in a queer, unaccustomed way, and the others seemed to have to help him. The robin used to secret himself in a bush and watch this anxiously. His head tilted first on one side and then on the other. He thought that the slow movements might mean he was preparing to pounce as cats do. When cats are preparing to pounce, they creep over the ground very slowly. The robin talked this over with his mate a great deal for a few days. But after that, he decided not to speak of the subject. Her terror was so great, he was afraid it might be injurious to the eggs. When the boy began to walk by himself, and even to move more quickly, it was an immense relief. But for a long time, or it seemed a long time to the robin, he was a source of some anxiety. He did not act as the other humans did. He seemed very fond of walking, but he had a way of sitting or lying down for a while, and then getting up in a disconcerting manner to begin again. One day, the robin remembered that when he himself had been made to learn to fly by his parents, he had done much the same sort of thing. He had taken short flights of a few yards, and then had been obliged to rest. So it occurred to him that this boy was learning to fly, or rather, to walk. He mentioned this to his mate, and when he told her that the eggs would probably conduct themselves in the same way after they were fledged, she was quite comforted, and even became eagerly interested, and derived great pleasure from watching the boy over the edge of her nest, though she always thought that the eggs would be much cleverer and learn more quickly. But then she said indulgently that humans were always more clumsy and slow than eggs, and most of them never seemed really to learn to fly at all. You never met them in the air or on treetops. After a while, the boy began to move about as the others did. But all three of the children at times did unusual things. They would stand under the trees and move their arms and legs and heads about in a way which was neither walking nor running nor sitting down. They went through these movements at intervals every day, and the robin was never able to explain to his mate what they were doing or trying to do. He could only say that he was sure that the eggs would never flap about in such a manner. But as the boy who could speak robin so fluently was doing the thing with them, birds could be quite sure that the actions were not of a dangerous nature. Of course, neither the robin nor his mate had ever heard of the champion wrestler Bob Haworth and his exercises for making muscles stand out like lumps. And that is where we close the book tonight on this episode of Down to Sleep. Until next time, thank you and good night.